Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and now that the CMJ Festival has ended here in New York, we have a moment to check in on the concert we co-presented with the CBGB Festival. That's the one that took place the week before CMJ. We'll bring you some live music from the veteran rock band The Meat Puppets, recorded at Brooklyn Bowl. And almost 50 years ago, they were rocking the shtetls on Broadway. We'll look at the cultural phenomenon that is Fiddler on the Roof. But first, Thomas Dolby. You know his hit songs, She Blinded Me with Science, Hyperactive, and the rest. But did you know that Thomas Dolby is also an international man of mystery?
It's been confirmed that a lighthouse in Suffolk, which is under threat from the sea, will be closed. It's thought it could collapse within a few years.
My name's Thomas Dolby. I'm trying to find out a date when the Orford Lighthouse is going to close.
I'm afraid that information is classified.
Because I'd really like to be there to film it, if that's at all possible.
No, that's really far too dangerous.
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Okay.
Look, you can't just go wandering around out there all on your own. The place is littered with unexploded warheads for a start. Mr. Dolby.
Oh, that's not going to end well. Or will it? Because actually, Thomas Dolby is here, seemingly intact, and bringing a film and music project called The Invisible Lighthouse, the result of his potentially dangerous and probably illegal attempt to document the closing of his local lighthouse. Thomas lives on a retrofitted lifeboat on the east coast of England. Thomas, good to see you in one piece and out of jail.
Thanks, John. It's nice to be back.
What was the lure of this lighthouse that you grew up near?
You know, I've seen it flashing on my bedroom wall since I can remember. And when I moved back from the USA to England about 6 years ago with my family, part of the reason was that I wanted my kids to experience what I'd experienced when I was young. And so some things change, as they do, and there's progress and there's erosion. But one of the most notable things was that I found out this lighthouse, the Orford Lighthouse, was going to be closed and decommissioned this year. And this made me very sad. It's going to fall into the North Sea sooner or later, like the 11 lighthouses before it that have been recorded on that point. But the fact that they were switching it off and I would no longer see that flash and nor would my kids was very evocative for me.
So you decided to document the end of this lighthouse and with it, I guess, the end of an era.
Well, yeah. I mean, the lighthouse was sort of iconic for me and was really a symbol of the coast where I grew up, which had so much to do with my music, with my songwriting. I don't write pop songs about text message breakups and sort of things like that. I tend to write about the weather, about geography, about atmospheric conditions, about parallel universes, about what if. And all of this, a lot of it I put down to, you know, where I grew up, which is this fantastic piece of coast. It's not rolling green hills and thatched cottages. It's not what you would expect. But it is the coast that has faced repeated failed invasions by, you know, Napoleon and the Nazis and the Vikings and so on. And you see the remnants of the sea defenses crumbling into the beach. So it's a very atmospheric place.
And so what were the roadblocks? Why couldn't you just, you know, go over to the island and film to your heart's content?
Well, Orford Ness, which is kind of an island, it is actually linked, but by a very narrow strip of shingle beach, is considered an island and was formerly owned by the Ministry of Defence because for most of the 20th century, they did experimental weapons testing there. For example, the first parachute jump ever done anywhere was done on Orford Ness. And they had all sorts of strange things like a death ray that could stop an aircraft engine at a distance of 5 miles. And then during the Cold War, they were testing detonators for military warheads. They claimed that there were no nukes there. But there are these strange pagodas out on the island with these roofs designed to collapse in the event a device went off by mistake. So they don't like people wandering around out there. And it's now controlled by the National Trust because it has many specimens of unique plants that grow there. So you're allowed to do tours, but you have to stay on the road and you have to follow a docent around. And I needed to wander out there and capture the last flash of the lighthouse from all different angles on the island. So when I got no cooperation from the authorities, I sort of decided to take the law into my own hands.
And what form did that take?
Well, I mounted a clandestine commando raid at dawn on the island with spy cameras rolling. So I got a little inflatable rib, high-speed rib, and I plotted...
That's a rigid inflatable boat.
Yeah. And I plotted this one particular cove I could pull into on the island, which would be out of line of sight of the docents. And I had a narrow window of tide when I can get in there. And I had these cool GoPro cameras that sort of surfers and skateboarders use that have all sorts of, you know, waterproof enclosures and things. And I had a quadricopter camera, you know, like a little helicopter thing that you fly from your iPhone, that was following me around. And I walked off across Orford Ness with these cameras rolling. And I thought, well, if I bump into an unexploded ordnance, then at least it's going to provide a suitable climax for the film. But here I am in one piece.
Wow. I mean, it sounds like you had everything except the cane that turns into a machine gun. Or a very, very James Bond, this experience.
Well, yes, although to do it with a James Bond-style crew and budget would not have been feasible. They would have just said no.
Right.
But the fact is that the equipment for video has gotten cheap and affordable and really good. And this is revolutionizing filmmaking. You know, you can now do stuff on your own and you can wander around, you know, around the streets looking like a tourist, you know, with a little camera on a tripod. And this is fantastic. And it's parallel to what happened 20, 25 years earlier with music, mm-hmm. where suddenly instead of, you know, needing a label and a record company, a budget, you could go make a record in your back room and distribute it over the internet. And it produced fantastic changes in music and leveled the playing field. And I think the same thing is starting to happen with video and filmmaking.
Well, one of the results is Thomas Dolby's new live music and film project called The Invisible Lighthouse. Let's hear a little bit.
It's not the picture postcard England of thatched cottages and Buckingham Palace. But this place is in my bones. And it seeped into my chord changes and lyrics. And these secret locations became the backdrop for my photo and video shoots. I was 14, she was 12. Father traveled, hers as well. Europa. Down on beaches, hand in hand, 12 and never on the sand. Then war took her away. We swore a vow that day.
Thomas Dolby and The Invisible Lighthouse, a music and film experience, which Thomas is bringing here to New York on October 28th at the Gramercy Theater, and for our listeners in Detroit, November 3rd at the Royal Oak Music Theater in Royal Oak, Michigan. So you made the film, and as we've already heard, it sort of leads you into songs both old and new from your catalog. Did you always know that the sea had this kind of impact, or was this something you kind of realized later in your career?
I think I realized going back and creating the soundtrack for the film that many of my songs from the beginning had this very strong influence of the sea and of the countryside where I grew up. My ancestors are from around there. You can see old buildings that were built by my great-grandfather that are still there, that are, some of them crumbling, some of them still around. And, you know, I'm aware that this is also a legacy that I'm sort of passing on to my kids with a few changes. The lighthouse will be gone, but there is Europe's largest wind farm being built offshore just on the horizon. You can just occasionally see it when the sun is glinting on the blades. And, you know, I wrote a song called Wind Power back in 1980, so it's great to see this sort of coming to fruition. And I sit in my lifeboat watching the strange vehicles taking these turbines out to the North Sea, going in and out. I've become a bit of a train spotter.
Thomas Dolby with us on Soundcheck, talking about his project called The Invisible Lighthouse. How do you refer to this? Is it a documentary? It's almost more like an intervention, it seems.
Well, it is, really. It's sort of, well, it's a docu-tour, really, because I decided not to release the film commercially, at least for now. The only way to experience the film is to come and see it when I perform it live. And when I project it, and I do the narration and the instrumental score and the songs and even the Foley sound effects are live on stage in the theatre. And so I think it makes for a very unique experience.
So Blake Lee, is it, who's your Foley artist?
Blake Lay, yeah.
Lay.
He's a world-class sound designer. I mean, he's credited with sound design on things like The Abyss and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. He was the music supervisor on The Wire and Tremé. This is like a world-class talent, and he's sort of slumming it with me out in the road, but he does live Foley, so he has a pit of stones and twigs and leaves. He does the flapping of bird wings. He does the sound of the surf. You may have seen in you know, behind the scenes Hollywood films where there's a guy in front of the screen doing all of the sounds live. Well, he's doing that live on stage and playing a bit of guitar as well.
Right. Plays on Europa, for example, which we heard before. Going back to an earlier song of yours, Cloudburst at Shingle Street is one of this about half a dozen or so of your songs that are sort of woven into the fabric of this piece. How does this song come into play?
Well, Shingle Street is a tiny village on the coast where there was supposedly a repelled invasion in 1942. It had been evacuated because of the risk of invasion. And you have to remember that people at that time, they didn't know how long the war was going to last. The rest of Europe had fallen. You were almost close enough to the European mainland to see the panzer tanks lining up, you know, getting ready to invade. So people just assumed the Nazis were going to invade at any moment. And my granny lived there and used to poison half the food in her larder because she was so convinced the Germans were going to invade. So if you were a visitor...
So you had to be careful when you raided the pantry at grandma's house.
You had to memorize which food was safe to eat, yeah. So this was the way that they lived. And I found out about this, but when I went and walked this beach... And there was this fantastic storm while I was there. I got completely drenched. But it really seemed like I was sort of immersing myself. It's this sort of baptismal experience, you know, to be walking this beach and getting drenched. And that resulted in the song Cloudburst at Shingle Street.
From my guest Thomas Dolby on Soundcheck. Some of Cloudburst at Shingle Street from Thomas Dolby, who's with me on Soundcheck, as he does occasionally when there's new work involved, and the new work this time is called The Invisible Lighthouse, a film documenting the end, the decommissioning, the Orford Lighthouse near your home on England's eastern coast, facing the North Sea. So you mentioned before, you know, you've written so many songs about weather and natural elements and the sea and lifeboats and submarines and all this kind of stuff. Was that intentional, or, you know, do you just kind of look back at that and say, wow, I've done a heck of a lot of that sort of thing?
I've always been a bit contrary, you know. It's like when I started out, this is, you know, late 70s, early 80s, and it was the new wave. There were a lot of sort of you know, pin-up poster children that, you're Sting and you're Simon Le Bon and Adam Ant and so on. And I came from this very academic background. You know, my father was a professor of classical archaeology at Oxford. Many teachers in my family. I went to a private boarding school. I wasn't going to fit into this sort of mainstream pop thing, you know. So I kind of went the other way deliberately, and I avoided singing songs that are sort of in the moment about relationships and things, and tended to be a little bit more sort of geographical about the songs that I wrote. And that's just always been my way of doing things. But there's a sort of surreal aspect to my work also. It's sort of what if, you know, what if the microchip had never been invented and we had to run everything on cogs and clockwork and steam, you know? What if the Germans had invaded? How would things have turned out? You know, so often there's this sort of parallel universe to what I do. Mm-hmm. And in that situation, I always sort of cast myself as the dissident underground rebel, you know, with the ham radio set.
The guy who would take a rigid inflatable boat and make a pre-dawn raid on an island with spy cameras just because he wants to get his picture.
Precisely.
So how did the film turn out? I mean, is it kind of a panoramic view of the lighthouse? Is there more to it? Are there shots of the coast?
Well, the lighthouse links together multiple threads. There are stories about my predecessors, about how they came to be there. I mean, Britain was originally attached to Europe. You know, there was no North Sea thousands or millions of years ago. So my ancestors may have actually walked from Holland, you know, but it's steadily sinking and the British Isles are tipping and our coast is doomed. So there's a lot of different sort of aspects of that. Interesting stories as well. For example, one about a potential UFO encounter at Rendlesham Forest in 1980. This is viewed as Britain's
Sector 51?
Yeah, exactly. And three U.S. servicemen...
Area 51, sorry.
Yeah. Three U.S. servicemen believed they had an encounter with a UFO in the woods.
So wait, even in the U.K., it's Americans who are seeing the UFOs?
Funny that, isn't it? Funny that happens. Yeah. But among the debunking theories for this, as there always are, one is that they got spooked out. They came to a gap in the woods where you could see the flash of the lighthouse. And I retraced their steps and I went out there and I was a bit underwhelmed because the flash at that point was just this sort of puny thing and there's no way anybody could have mistaken that for a flying saucer. And I thought back to the fact that I remembered this epic sweeping beam of the lighthouse when I was a kid and I wondered if I was dreaming, because there was another story when I saw the roof of a building burn. This is a building that my great-great-grandfather built at Snake Maltings, which is used for the Aldborough Festival.
Right.
The roof burned when I was 10, and I remember watching it at night in terror across the marshes. And years later, my mum told me, look, I hate to tell you, we were never actually there. We were miles away that night. So this memory was an implanted memory, which has sort of become burned onto my retina.
Wow.
And I started questioning memory. And I wondered whether, in fact, these guys, as they've gone to UFO conventions and been interviewed by the Sci-Fi Channel and so on, whether they've sort of, you know, in their brains, it's become a bit scrambled, you know. And that is the nature of memory, is that you know, it becomes amplified and distorted over time. And again, this sort of became the undercurrent, really, for my film.
In dreams, the sky are azure blue, the sea's a mirror pond. Then you wake to howling wind and rain upon your roof tiles. It won't be long, it won't be very long. The superstitious sailors of old refuse to learn to swim, but there's no need to drown these days, 'cause we've got lifeboats. Where are the lifeboats? There are.
The film is called The Invisible Lighthouse, with live narration, live sound effects, and live music from Thomas Dolby. And as you tour around here in the States with this story of the Orford Lighthouse near your childhood home. You're trying to raise awareness for the various lighthouses that we have here in the States.
Well, it was really too late for me to do anything about the Orford Lighthouse because the sea has encroached almost to the foundations now, so it's going to crumble, and they had to get the mercury out and so on. But it turns out that around the U.S. coast and on its rivers, there are many endangered lighthouses that no longer serve as much of a navigational function because, you know, your smartphone has probably got better navigation on it at this point than these lighthouses. So all around America's coast and on the rivers, there are lighthouses that are at threat either from erosion or from vandalism. And there is a doomsday list of 46 of them. And since this doomsday list has been published, there have been some success stories, such as the Cape Hatteras,
Cape Hatteras.
Yeah, lighthouse, which has been successfully brought back. But there's also very many that are seriously at risk. The Cedar Island Lighthouse out in Sag Harbor, for example, is a very famous one. And they are under the domain of the Coast Guard, but they are nothing but a drain on the Coast Guard's budget. So it's really up to the private sector to try and do something about them. Some of them have passed into private ownership and are being set up as B&Bs. Some of them are too remote for that to happen. They're on islands and so on. But it's a big piece of America's heritage, and I think that we need to pay some attention to saving them.
And it is such a romantic, or to use a word you used earlier, evocative and atmospheric part of living near water.
It's amazing how many people have a pet lighthouse from their childhood, and they're going to miss them when they're gone.
The Invisible Lighthouse is Thomas Dolby's project, film and music and live narration and sound. New York at the Gramercy Theater on October 28th. And for our WDET listeners, November 3rd at Royal Oak Music Theater in Royal Oak, Michigan. Thomas Dolby, always something interesting every time you join us on Soundcheck. Thanks very much.
Nice to be here.
This piece, called Oceania, is part of Thomas Dolby's last music project, which was also a video game, and he made it on his lifeboat/studio in or on the North Sea coast, so it is directly related to the Invisible Lighthouse project we've been talking about. Let's hear a bit of it.
A nightingale sang above my mother's tomb, twilight in the afternoon. I stumble home to crocuses are still in bloom. I stumble home to Oceania. And you are